Skincare experts and dermatologists have often touted the benefits of indoor humidity as essential for healthy, glowing skin. But did you know dry air can start to harm your skin in as little as 30 minutes? For years, many people have relied on humidifiers for better skin, sleep, and overall wellness. But traditional models? Bulky, mold-prone, and difficult to maintain. That's where Canopy Humidifier comes in. Recommended by leading dermatologists, Canopy is a completely reimagined humidifier designed to elevate any space, offering the ultimate in skincare and wellness benefits. Canopy's clean moisture combats dryness, dullness, and fine lines while strengthening the skin's barrier and boosting the effectiveness of topical skincare products. With its sleek design, Canopy is the cleanest and easiest humidifier on the market. With its unique technology, cleaning is as easy as popping it in the dishwasher. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy humidifier purchase today with Canopy's filter subscription. Even better, use code PODCAST at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Your skin will thank you.
This episode of Food Psych is brought to you by my book, Anti-Diet: Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating, which is available wherever books are sold. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/book to order it now. That's ChristyHarrison.com/book. Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast about intuitive eating, health at every size, body liberation, and taking down diet culture. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm an anti-diet registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, and author of Anti-Diet. Join me here every week as I interview interesting people from all different backgrounds about their paths toward peace with food and their bodies. And by the way, on this show, we bleep out diet culture stuff like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome to episode 252 of Food Psych. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and today I'm talking with certified lactation counselor and writer Leslie Monio about diet culture in the infant nutrition field, trying to raise an intuitive eater, the difference between intuitive eating in children and adults, why we shouldn't judge people regardless of how they choose to feed themselves or their kids, and so much more. I can't wait to share a conversation with you in just a moment. But first, I'll answer this week's listener question, which is from a listener named McKenna, who writes, "Hi, Christy. I'm probably one of your youngest listeners. I'm 18, and I struggled with anorexia when I was 13. I went to treatment and have been in recovery ever since. I would say lately I've been more free with food than ever, and I have lately joined the Health at Every Size movement because of your podcast. How do I explain Hayes to my diet culture raised parents? They truly don't understand how people can be healthy in a larger body. This is because of what media and years of being immersed in diet culture has made them believe, but they are being so stubborn. I try to explain that health is different for everyone, but they insist on it being otherwise. They often comment on people's weight gain and bodies or how they eat, and it upsets me in a big way, but I don't know what to say." So thanks, McKenna, for that great question. And before I answer, just my usual disclaimer that these answers and this podcast in general are for informational and educational purposes only, aren't a substitute for individual medical or mental health advice, and don't constitute a provider-patient relationship. So yeah, this is a really tough question, and I think it's such a common issue for people who've recently learned about the Hayes paradigm. So, you know, it's really natural where you are right now, McKenna, to want to take all this mind-blowing information and knowledge that you've discovered about health at every size and spread it to the world, right? And that means talking about it with everyone you know, including your parents. But the thing that's really important to remember is that people have to be in a place where they're open to learning about health at every size and aren't just reflexively opposed to it. And I know that from experience because when I first heard about Hayes more than 10 years ago, I wasn't ready to accept it yet either. You know, I argued with the friend who introduced it to me, and I refused to deeply engage with the ideas or even read the books for a couple of years, right? I bought them when I was first debating with him about it, but I left them on my shelves for like 2 years. And it was only after I'd really admitted to myself that I had had an eating disorder and that my own relationship with food was still in the process of being healed and started working in the eating disorder field. Then I was able to really take in the messages of Hayes. But when they first were introduced to me, I was reflexively opposed to. And it sounds like your parents really aren't in that place of openness yet. They have decades of diet culture conditioning behind them. Plus, it sounds like they're struggling with their own relationships with food in their bodies because, you know, people don't generally comment on other people's weight gain or how they eat unless they're fixated on that stuff themselves, right? If you're really happy with your relationship with food in your body, you kind of have better things to do than to talk about other people's weight or how they eat. So, you know, it's a pretty sure sign if someone's making those comments that they're struggling themselves. And so, you know, I think it's really important not to try to debate with people who are in that place, who are really entrenched in diet culture, and not to debate them about the facts and the science, because their feelings and beliefs and disordered behaviors with food are probably preventing them from really being able to be open and engage with the information. And I get the sense that you also have a lot of emotion tied up in this, right? Which is so understandable given everything you've gone through in your own relationship with food. It's completely understandable and natural to feel emotional about your parents' comments, you know, and them being so invested in diet culture. So what I generally recommend in cases like this is to stop debating about the science and the facts and instead address the emotions. Talk about the emotional impact that their comments are having on you. You can point out that you know it's unintentional, but when they comment on people's weight gain and bodies and how they eat, it actually harms your recovery and it stirs up eating disorder thoughts in your brain. And your parents already know about your history and your efforts at recovery over the years. And of course, they love you and want the best for you. So reminding them about your struggles with your eating disorder, I think, is really the best way to go about these conversations, not to debate about the science, but to make it about you and your experience. And so just, you know, I'd really keep it focused on that rather than on talking about other people's health or making it this abstract thing about the science. Tell your parents how it makes you feel to hear them do diet and weight talk, and then set boundaries around that kind of talk. So what that might look like is you could say something like, you know, it really hurts me to hear you judge other people's bodies and food choices because it makes me feel like you could be judging me in the same way. And even if you would never judge me like that, it still triggers the eating disorder voice in my head and makes me think about going back to harmful behaviors. So I would really appreciate it if you would just stop making those kinds of comments when I'm around. And, you know, sometimes people can still get a little bit defensive when you set boundaries like this. But if you just keep reminding them that it's about protecting you and your recovery, it's not about telling them that they're wrong or telling them what to do, it usually goes over a lot better than when you try to debate them about the science and the facts, because then they feel like you're telling them they're wrong, you're telling them that their worldview is wrong, that the way they approach food in their bodies is wrong, and they get defensive and shut down. So if you can make it about you and what you need, especially when it's with people who love you and know your story, it tends to work a lot better. And then, of course, the other piece of setting boundaries is that you'll need to consistently reinforce those boundaries, because people tend not to notice in our culture when they slip into diet and weight loss talk because it's so ingrained in all of us, right? Being raised in diet culture makes those things kind of feel second nature sometimes. And so you might need to point it out to them many times before they start to catch themselves, before they start to recognize, oh, this is the kind of thing that McKenna was talking about. And part of reinforcing boundaries is also setting consequences, right? So you might need to change the subject or leave the room if they do it again, right? A number of times you might need to do this for them to really get the message that you're serious about this boundary and that you don't want to hear diet talk and weight loss talk around you. And so if you can do that, if you can set and reinforce that boundary, it helps protect you from harmful diet and weight talk. It helps protect your recovery. And it also plants the seed for your parents to understand how those things affect you and anyone else within earshot when they say them. And so over time, your parents might start to recognize how problematic some of their thinking about food and weight really is. And they may even, at some point, become more open to discussing health at every size with you without getting defensive and without shutting down. But again, that's not the immediate goal here, right? And some people never get to that place. Some people never get to a place where they're open. And even if they do, it can take years, right? As I described for me, it took a couple of years before I got to the place where I was really ready and receptive to that message. So in the meantime, you know, if that happens or it doesn't, just try to recognize that you can't push your parents or rush them to change their beliefs, right? You can't make anyone believe anything that they don't want to believe that they're not ready for, and that they may never change. You can't make anyone change. They have to be ready for change. But you can still work to create an environment that is more supportive of your recovery just by setting boundaries on diet and weight loss talk with them so that being around them is a more pleasant and pro-recovery experience. So I hope that helps. And if you want to submit your own question for a chance to have it answered on an upcoming episode, just go to ChristyHarrison.com/questions. That's ChristyHarrison.com/questions. And then if you want a whole library of answers from me to help you master intuitive eating, plus the chance to ask me any question you want or lots of questions and have me answer them much more quickly than I can here in an exclusive monthly Q&A podcast that I do, you can come join my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. The course has 13 modules of content teaching you the principles of intuitive eating, plus a special Q&A podcast for members, which has hundreds of answers to people's questions about intuitive eating. And when you join the course, you can ask me your questions and have me answer them in the following month's Q&A. So that's a really easy way to get your questions answered pretty quickly. Participants really love the Q&As, and they've told me that they help it feel like a really special personal touch to the course. And another thing that they really love is our private community forum, which is exclusively for course participants. And I'm in there interacting with people regularly, so they feel really supported by me and my wonderful team. And it's also just an incredible group of people in there. So your fellow participants in the forum are so kind, so supportive. And, you know, it's so important to have a community when you're going against the grain of diet culture and everyone else in your life, like your parents or your best friend or whoever, you know, is talking about dieting and clean eating and trying to lose weight or whatever it might be. So we need communities where we can go for a refuge from all that diet culture stuff and really get re-energized to go out and fight diet culture some more, because it's a long and hard battle. So if you're ready to become an intuitive eater and leave diet culture behind with a great community of people supporting you to do it, come learn more and sign up for the course at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. And now, without any further ado, let's go to my conversation with Leslie Monio. So tell me about your relationship with food growing up.
My mom was kind of a dieter, and I thought about it, you know, in preparation for this, kind of just looking back, and I didn't have any food restrictions or anything like that as a kid. It definitely wasn't something like forced on me, but it was so prevalent in every adult woman around me. Just all my adult family members and my mom, it seemed, were constantly dieting. And my mom in particular, when I thought about it for a minute, I realized that my mom really had some disordered eating stuff. And I remember periods of time, especially when I was a young child, like 5 to 7, that's kind of hazy memory. But I do remember my mom just didn't eat a lot, you know, like she just often didn't eat. My dad in particular was sort of a like macho dude who, or faux macho dude, who really idolized a certain look in women. He had a ton of like Playboy magazines around. He was like the type of guy to really love going to Hooters, if that makes sense. And so this sort of like Pamela Anderson Jenny McCarthy ideal of what a beautiful woman looked like was also really prevalent in my head. So when we're talking about food specifically, to me, it's like the food that we ate didn't match up with that ideal, really. Like, it was sort of like typical Midwest kid food. I grew up in the South, but my mom's from Illinois. So I grew up eating just a ton of like tuna casserole and spaghetti and really easy, convenient, cheap kind of weeknight dinners. But I also had this idea that I should look a certain way. It wasn't until I was older that those two things became a problem and like lined up, that I started to realize that the way I was eating, it didn't match what I was supposed to be striving for from a cultural expectation point of view. And I don't think anything that I was eating was wrong now. And in fact, some of it is like my most favorite food and comfort food and stuff I feed my own daughter today. But I remember having like a lot of resentment, especially in my teen years, towards my family for like feeding me this and me gaining weight and then this being my norm. And I grew up in the South too, which was like, there's a ton of fried food in the South, a ton of seafood, which is so delicious. And I'm still such a fan today. And when we had big family events, it centered around a lot of Cajun cooking, Southern cooking, like gumbo and po' boys and hush puppies and fried catfish and stuff. And that was sort of like what an Easter would be, or a Christmas would be, there would be a big pot of gumbo or red beans and rice or something like that.
It sounds delicious.
Yeah. And it was never encouraged for me to like not eat any of that. It took me time to catch up to that sort of culturally pervasive expectation that I not eat the things that I loved.
And it sounds like you came to blame the foods for your body size later on. Like, you came to think of like those foods as the culprit. And in order to shrink your body and change yourself, you needed to eat completely differently.
Yes. That's a really accurate way to say it, actually. A little more articulately than I did. But yeah. And I started to definitely have some eating disordered behavior, I guess would be a term for it. I've never, like a lot of people, I've never been like officially diagnosed with an eating disorder, but I for sure have exhibited a lot of the behaviors that I've learned about over time.
I know. I think that's so common. It's like basically anyone who's dieted has engaged in disordered eating behaviors. And
yes. And I was a gung-ho dieter in my early 20s. And my sort of like, yeah, early 20s would be the time frame for sure of when I was the most restrictive and the most disordered. Yeah.
How did that start for you?
So it began pretty innocently. I got the same message that a lot of people get, which is that like eating less or eating a different way is healthier. And my dad had a heart attack. And he survived. He was fine. But I wanted to help him. And I read a book that was written by like a heart doctor. And it was a diet book. I don't want to say the name of it because I don't want to lead people to it. But it was essentially sort of advocating for a mostly vegetarian diet. If you had meat, it needed to be a certain kind of meat and very little of it if you had it. And so it started there with like about a year of like vegetarianism that I was like, Dad, if you do this, I'll do this. And this will be better for your heart and we'll both lose weight and that'll be so good for us. So that was the beginning. But that was just the beginning. Like, it spiraled out way later. So what would happen to me, which I'm sure happens to so many people who diet, is that it would become unsustainable. I would start to binge. And usually my excuse was that I like went on vacation. Has anyone told you these things before?
Oh, yes. It's so funny how it becomes like blame your life, blame yourself, look for the culprit, anything but, oh, the diet was unsustainable.
Yes, right. And so I would always be like, well, you know, I went on vacation and then that's not my fault. So then I would kind of go back to eating just now the way that I eat, which I just give myself permission to have whatever I want, whenever I want. But back then I had been in such a long period of restriction that I really went for it, you know, which a lot of people do and is very understandable.
Yeah, that pendulum swinging from restriction to feeling sort of out of control or overabundant, quote unquote, you know, not that it's over, but it's correcting for the restriction that was there before.
Exactly. And then at some point, my self-esteem would be very low and I would decide to restrict again. So I would go on a new diet or a new plan or a new version. And I did several. And I did that until my last diet, which I've not been on a diet since then. Which was, I will say this book, just because it's so evil, I want people to know how evil it is, I think. I went on this diet.
Oh, God.
Yes. Which is just, even the title is evil.
Totally. Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah. And I tell people about that one only because I think it's pretty obvious that it is a terrible diet. So if people aren't aware of this book, I don't want to sell this book, but I would say, here's what to look out for in this book. It makes itself, it's basically a very strict case for veganism, which with my vegetarianism, I was already like inclined toward. But it's a very strict case for veganism, but not just veganism. Like no sugar, no alcohol, no like no caffeine, like a whole bunch of things that also don't have anything to do with veganism. And it uses really moralistic, scary language. It makes you feel bad for eating any kind of animal product at all. And it uses the most degrading language toward you. And if you hate yourself, you're already inclined to believe that, you know? And I really hated myself at that point in time. I also had some friends that were on highly restrictive diets at the time, and I think I felt competitive with them too. And so they were on a different diet, which is one of the craziest ones I've ever heard of, by the way. It was basically they were eating a very low amount of calories. I won't say the number, but far too low, like than anyone would ever tell you to eat. And getting injections of like, you know this, have you heard this before?
I've heard this, yeah.
Yes. And getting injections that were supposedly, I don't know, to keep you alive. But it was starvation is what it really was. Of course, not sustainable. A friend of mine had serious health complications and was hospitalized for a moment after going on that particular diet. And we were all doing this at the same time and all feeding into each other and definitely very unhealthy. And then that became so unsustainable that I started secretly binging. So I would be eating like, as I say, like just plain. And I would be like at night, at like 11 o'clock at night, sneaking out of my apartment. I lived with a roommate at the time, sneaking out of my apartment, going to Wendy's and eating like, you know, and whatever.
Just making it up for everything you'd been missing all day, every day.
Yeah. Secretly alone in my car at night. And I was big into like hiding food. I didn't want people to see me failing. And that was a tough time. Eventually, I don't know if you're headed here, but I was mentally pulled out of this fog.
What was that like?
I've written about this before. So I'm sure there's very few people that have read anything that I've written that listen to you, but I have written about this before. So if you ever check me out and read something about it, just know I am repeating myself. But I was reading Oprah magazine. It's so funny to me because I have such complicated feelings about Oprah. But I'm a big fan, but also like I feel that her diet culture legacy is a shame. So anyway, reading her magazine, and there was an article about fat acceptance. And it was a young woman contributed. I don't remember the author. I wish that I did. And I've tried to look her up to give her credit for changing my life. But she talked a lot about dieting and choosing to just accept being fat and her relationship with her mother. And if anyone knows this article, please let me know.
Yeah, definitely. Like email us if you know this, because I'm so curious about this too. It's like, it's wild that Oprah would have had that in her magazine.
Yes. And I had never even heard the phrase fat acceptance. It was like a foreign language to me. I was like, what? And I was very skeptical, as many people are. I was so like, what are they talking about? Huh? You know? But this lady sounded so confident and so at peace. And I just craved it. I craved the feeling that she was describing. And something about it rang really true to me. And so I started looking into fat acceptance blogs. And the internet was like very different than it is now. If you Googled fat acceptance now, you would get a lot of good information. But when I did this, it was like very subversive. And it was only written about on like a lot of people's private blogs. And mainstream publications weren't discussing it. There certainly wasn't a wonderful book out there like yours that was readily available. I think Intuitive Eating was out, but I didn't know anything about it. And it certainly wasn't like popping up in my Google search, you know. But I started reading these blogs, and I give a lot of credit to Kate Harding. Are you familiar with Kate Harding?
Yes. Oh, love her.
Her blog, Shapely Prose, which is shut down, but still has the FAQ. You can still go read the frequently asked questions on Shapely Prose. And reading that FAQ, that was it. I never went back. I absolutely became health at every size, intuitive eating, give myself permission to eat anything. It freed me completely. That does not mean that I never regressed. I did. And I've had several times over the years where I've regressed. But what do they call it in like Alcoholics Anonymous?
Oh, relapse.
Relapse. Yes. That's what I would call it. It was like a relapse for me.
They say relapse is part of recovery too. Sometimes the process has to involve that regression, that circling back to kind of know for sure that you don't want to do it again.
Yes. And I could point to different points in time where I've recommitted. But that for sure was like the starting point. And it's something I've been passionate about. And I talk about it to anybody. I was talking about it at my daughter's little best friend. Her little five-year-old best friend at her birthday party. It's so, honestly, like so many of these women at these birthday parties are like, what planet are you from? But it came up and I was like, well, get ready for the soapbox, guys.
I mean, that's awesome that you're able to talk about it anywhere, because I think it can be daunting and some people don't have that sort of gumption to do it. But I think when you can do that and talk about it in places where people need that information, because who doesn't? It's really planting seeds for everyone. It's like it's doing such good in the world.
Yeah. I think a lot of moms will relate to this, being at the kid's birthday party and other moms talking about feeling guilty about the food that they're eating at the kid's birthday party. And that comes up all the time. And I go to a lot of kids' birthday parties because I'm a mom of a five-year-old. And it's for sure, it's really prevalent for whatever reason, in particular at kids' birthday parties. And yeah, that's because it's prevalent in the culture, I'm sure. But I don't know why it always kind of triggers me when I'm there. And then I end up talking about it.
Yeah, I feel like the food rules that people are following in their day-to-day lives temporarily are put on pause at kids' birthday parties. But then people have all kinds of feelings about that. And they get really in their feelings and can't stop talking about it.
Well, and I think also in particular, you feel maybe judged by other moms. Like maybe the spotlight is on you, that you need to sort of say this is not your norm for some reason, like so that other people don't think less of you or judge you or something.
Right. And especially if you're marginalized in other ways, especially if you're already fat, there's that added piece of like the weight stigma that people are likely to come in with, that you've probably experienced in life and sort of know to look out for. You're trying to like head that off at the pass, maybe.
Yeah. And I use the term fat for myself, although I'm not sure everybody would for me. I think I have a degree of thin privilege. But for me, I use it. That's what my lived experience has been. I absolutely recognize that it's not the same as people who are in larger bodies than me. But yeah, that's what my experience has been. And when I have used it, oh my gosh, that is so triggering to people who don't know anything about, you know, health at every size or diet culture. Like, I remember a very thin friend of mine who had never heard anything about it. I said that about myself, and I was writing about it in a really, like, I think, articulate way, in a way that explained what I meant. And she kind of came after me online. She was like, you should never say that about yourself. It's an insult, dot, dot, dot. And I was like, not the way I'm using it. That's not what I, you know, I think her intention was to try to make me feel good, but it took a minute for her to hear me on what I was saying.
Yeah, the fact that she believes that that's an insult is like, it really shows where she's coming from.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you get to that place of feeling comfortable talking about it to everyone you know? Because I'm sure when you first discovered Shapely Prose and delved into the fatosphere, and by the way, for anyone who wants to like delve into this work, the book Lessons from the Fatosphere, I think is wonderful. And it's Marion Kirby and Kate Harding together writing about what they've learned from doing this like early fat acceptance blogging. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I love Kate Harding's other work too. She writes about a lot of topics, a lot of feminist topics, and she's a great writer.
Yeah. So, you know, when you first discovered that, like how did that start to take root in your life? And how did you, you know, what was like your relationship with food like after that, and your relationship with your body? How did that all change?
Well, the first thing that happened was that I gave myself permission to eat anything that I wanted. I think that's the first step for me. And I think it's a helpful first step for others. I think if you are really struggling with disordered eating, maybe that's not your first step. I don't know. But for somebody who is really ready to shed the pain of diet culture, that was a big first step for me. And what I found, and I think a lot of people find this, was that as soon as I gave myself that permission, and it was a daily choice. Okay, it was an everyday, I had to retrain my brain a little bit to do this. Every meal, every snack, every time I experienced hunger, I had to have like a little powwow internally, you know, to do it. But when I would do it, I found that sometimes I wanted the food and sometimes I didn't. But as soon as the pressure was off, mentally, I was free. And that was so powerful, such a relief. It was such a strong feeling that it was undeniable. I once had a therapist tell me, I was in a really stressed out period of time in my life. And she said, I just want you to imagine just for a minute what it would feel like if you didn't have these problems that are stressing you out. Just imagine, just like for a moment. And I did. And the relief that I felt in that moment was so strong. just imagining it made me actually feel the relief. And I could physically feel a change in my body. And that was what happened every time I gave myself permission. So that was the first step for me. And then as far as body acceptance goes, it changed a lot. I started to dress differently. I started to dress in ways that I had wanted to for a long time, but had denied myself permission to dress. And I felt more beautiful. I felt happier. What I found was that everything in my life changed after my thinking changed. All of a sudden, I don't know what exactly it was. I don't know if I really was just getting more attention from men, or if I was noticing it and it had always been there, but now I was noticing it or accepting it or whatever. But I felt like it started raining men. And I'm not saying that should be everyone's reason, but for me, it was very influential. And I really craved a more fulfilling love life. And that happened. And then I started to notice things. Like, my body is so similar to my mother's body. It's so similar to the body of all the women in my family. We all look really similar, all my aunts, my mom's sisters. And I realized that none of them looked like Pamela Anderson or Jenny McCarthy or whatever this idea was in my head of like that I needed to look like a Playboy playmate. And I look like them. We have a similar body type. Like, I think this is just what I'm supposed to look like. I think this is just what my body wants to be. And then I also heard somewhere a really good thing that helped too. And I also did a lot of therapy that helped too. But the thing that I heard was we can never actually fully see ourselves and know what we fully look like. Because most of the time, if we are seeing ourselves, we're only seeing ourselves in a mirror or in a photograph. And it's just not physically possible for our eyes to see ourselves at 360 degrees most of the time. So you can't ever really know. And if you don't ever fully, completely really know, and I know this is a little woo-woo, but it helped me. And I don't know if it might help someone else. But it basically, it changed one big thing, which was that it made me go, okay, I have a choice here. I have a choice. I can choose to keep believing that I am ugly and worthless, and that's one choice. Or I can choose to believe that I'm beautiful and have tons of self-worth and am a wonderful person and am a good-looking person. And that choice makes me feel better. So why not make that choice? It just simplified it. It was like, oh, I am making a choice when I am engaging in negative self-talk. And another good moment I had, which had nothing to do with my weight or anything or the way I looked, was I was in New York. I used to live in New York, and I had my Metro card out to get on the subway, and I dropped it and I went, oh, you fucking idiot. Like, so harsh. And because I was doing this good emotional work and sort of changing my brain a little bit at the time, I caught myself and I actually noticed it and was aware of that moment. And it felt so harsh and so mean and so angry and so uncalled for. And it made me think, if I saw anyone in the world drop their Metro card, I would never say to them, you fucking idiot, ever in a million years. So why am I saying that to myself? Why am I saying that to myself? Why is it okay for me to say it to me when I would never say that? And that, I mean, all these little pieces get put together as soon as I think you dive into your mental health around food. It puts more puzzle pieces together than just the issues with food, you know?
It's really amazing how that works. Like, it just ripples out into all areas of life, that sort of idea of intuition and paying attention to your desires with food and your body's needs and cues can have such profound effects on everything else.
Yes. And I started to enjoy food, enjoy the way I looked, enjoy my body, be sexually active again. I hadn't been sexually active for a long time. And I started to enjoy that. I started to accept compliments, accept people being nice to me, be kinder to myself. And I just think once you're getting all these wonderful benefits of giving up diet culture, you don't want to let go of that. And it was just a really real experience for me, which was great because it had such tangible effects that dieting never had. Dieting never gave what it promised, but fat acceptance gave me more than I could have dreamed.
That's awesome too, that you were in a place to really receive that and like be open to it. Because I think probably, you know, who knows, if you had discovered fat acceptance 5 or 10 years before, maybe it wouldn't have resonated. You know, I wonder if there was a part of it that was just like you were sort of at the end of your rope with diets and you realized they hadn't given you what they promised.
Yeah. I remember standing in a grocery store in New York that's not there anymore. They closed it down, but it was a food emporium, if anybody knows those. And it was right by my work. I worked on the Upper West Side, and it was my favorite place to get dinner after work because they had a lot of prepared food that was like yummy, but it wasn't necessarily fast food or something, you know, and I didn't have to cook it, but it was convenient, but it was delicious. So this was like one of my favorite places to eat, and I was heartbroken when they closed it. But I remember one night in sort of a place of relapse, somebody in my apartment was going on a diet and I don't know why, but I decided to do it with them.
Was it one of those like lifestyle changes where you're like, oh, it's not about the weight loss, it's about my health?
I mean, I can't even remember. I think somebody wanted to eat vegan for a week or I don't even remember, honestly. I have no idea what it was. And I was like, oh, I used to be vegan, I can do that. I don't know. It was just a weird moment of relapse, but it did all the things that it was designed to do, which made me feel horrible about myself. And my body responded to the restriction, and so did my brain. And I remember standing in the grocery store, staring for 30 minutes at the dessert case and wanting to get a piece of cheesecake and mentally just beating myself up over it. And I stopped and I was like, what are you doing? You know better than this. You know, you are a grown woman. You can have anything you want. This is your money. This is your body. This is your mouth, your stomach. You can have the cheesecake if you want it. I can't tell you if I got the cheesecake or not, because I literally don't remember. But I do remember that that was it. You know, like that was the end. I was like, okay, this week is over. I'm not going to do this anymore.
So even that like tiny little foray, that dipping your toe back into diet culture waters, just was like, no.
Yeah. So just about a week of that. And it might not have even been the full week. I don't remember. Just going there at all brought me straight back into disordered stuff and mentally unhealthy stuff. But then I was able to stop it. Thank God, you know, thank God I was able to stop it. And I felt better and I felt the same rush of relief. And I felt more powerful after that, because it was almost like a weird like test. And I got to the point where if I started to think about dieting, I could recognize that as, oh, something else is going on. Like, I need to check in with my therapist. What are my feelings right now? What's going on in my heart? What need is not being met? What am I feeling? It became such an obvious, like, oh, I feel out of control in some way. That's why I'm thinking about dieting.
That's such a useful signal.
Yeah. I learned to just, oh, wait, hey, I'm thinking about going gluten-free or whatever for no reason. Why am I considering that? Oh, okay. Maybe it's because I'm stressed out with my boss who I feel doesn't respect me, you know, or whatever the situation was.
Yeah. People could really take a cue from that for sure. And I talk about this with my clients and online course participants a lot, is like getting under what that means. Because definitely it can feel so real and it can feel so much like I have to do this for my health, or I have to do this because my body is just completely out of control / you know, too big / whatever. And certainly experiences of weight stigma can make it feel that way, can make it feel like that really is the thing. But it really is not the thing. You know, it's like there's always something more going on in these desires to lose weight when you've been able to get away from it. And even when you're still in the process of recovery, but you've like made some effort towards recovery and seen some of the freedom that could be there for you, and then you start feeling this desperate pull back into it, I feel like that is always a signal that something else is going on. And that something else could be something in your life that has nothing to do with your body size, or it could be something that is triggering internalized weight stigma that was already there, right? Like an experience of weight stigma from a doctor or from a partner or some, you know, friend or something like that. But that doesn't mean you have to diet.
Yeah. For me, what it always came down to is, I wrote a blog about this a while ago, but I call them the big fat lies, which is the first lie that thin is the only way to be beautiful. If you're not thin, you're unlovable. And that if you're not thin, you should try as hard as you can to be thin. You should be not just as thin as possible, but actually thinner than possible. And that is not actually possible for many people to even achieve. And that if it's not working, it's your fault. And it's so funny to me, because I will say a version of this to people that I know. And I'll say, okay, so this fails for 95 to 98% of people. That's the statistic. So why in the world, and many other people have put this the same way, that this isn't my idea, but if it's failing for the strongest majority of people, we wouldn't prescribe that to anyone for any other condition. We would not take a medicine for an illness that failed 98% of the time and caused horrifying side effects. We just wouldn't do that. And for some reason, it's still hard for people to hear. And I think it's just because it's a really powerful message coming from the other side that we've all grown up with. But I do think it's getting better. I do think there's a long way to go, you know, which is why I talk about it. I don't know why I'm confident talking about it. You asked that earlier. I'm not sure if I really answered that. I think I'm just confident because I am a kind of a loud mouth. Once I get my hands on an idea that I think is true, I have to talk about it. I'll give a lot of credit to you too. And I think the first person I heard the phrase from, self-compassion, came from you.
Oh, wow.
And that really rung true. And so that's my strategy. Am I being hard on myself? Self-compassion. Am I judging myself or others? Self-compassion. Am I thinking about dieting right now? Self-compassion. And I don't know why, but that particular phrase is a real light in the dark for me.
I mean, it sounds like it really dovetails with a lot of what you were doing in therapy and working on already, of just noticing your internal monologue and what it was saying to you and how harsh you could be with yourself and trying to push back against that.
Yeah, therapy was great. I'm not in therapy right now, but I always go back to it when I feel that I need it.
Same. Yeah.
I think everybody would benefit from a little bit of therapy.
Oh, yeah. Agreed. Well, I'm curious how you're having your daughter and pregnancy and postpartum and raising a kid has played into your relationship with food and your body. It sounds like you were really in a good place with it and you had discovered fat acceptance even before pregnancy. So hopefully that was able to help insulate you from some of the bullshit that comes up around that, right?
I wish that were true. But no, pregnancy brought a lot of it up. I wish I hadn't gone through some of the things I did in pregnancy. So here was the number one problem with pregnancy for me, which was that there are some things in pregnancy that are required that are restrictive. And I had been totally unrestrictive and all of a sudden now had to be restrictive. And as I discussed before, just even the thought of restriction takes me to a negative place. So all of a sudden it's required.
So even if it's like, don't eat deli meats for 9 months and you're like, oh, all I want is deli meats, or...
First of all, let me just say that was a burden for me because I love deli meats.
So do I.
And
I'd be so sad.
Yes. And I had hyperemesis while I was pregnant. So it was a rough pregnancy anyway. Food became... If anyone doesn't know what hyperemesis is... A lot of celebrities have had it recently. Kate Middleton and Amy Schumer both had it. It's constant morning sickness. Many people have to be hospitalized for it. I heard a statistic that 1 in 4 women with hyperemesis lose the baby. So I feel very fortunate that I survived hyperemesis. I did not have to be hospitalized, and my daughter is very healthy and alive today. But food became a huge chore for me in my life. It just became so triggering because anything could make me sick. And it wasn't just food. It was also, if I got overheated, I could throw up. If I had brushed my teeth, I could throw up. And it was not pleasant. It was very painful, very triggering. My intention was to work like the whole time. And I just wasn't able to do that. I was basically bedridden my whole pregnancy. I intentionally am going to have only one child because I can't put my body through that again. I've thought a lot about having another child at some point just because I love children and I sort of think it would be nice to give my daughter a sibling. But if I do choose to have another child, it will most likely not be through a pregnancy. I don't think that I could handle it again. And where I started with this, with the deli meat, was that when I was like a singleton in New York in my 20s, I would go out drinking a lot. My hangover cure was like a sandwich from a bodega, like a turkey sandwich or a ham sandwich or something on a roll, was like my hangover cure treat. I just loved having that. And now I'm throwing up all the time, feeling like I'm hungover all the time because of the nausea and the vomiting, and can't have that. Can't have that comfort food. And there are controversial opinions about that. Some people think you can have deli meat. I won't try to say, but for me, it was something that felt like a risk and I didn't want to take it. The particular risk that people talk about with deli meat or cheeses or things from the deli is listeria, which listeria a lot of people will experience in their life, and it might not really harm them at all, but in pregnancy, it can be fatal to the fetus. So that's why you try to avoid listeria. That was my main reason for avoiding deli meat. But boy, did I want it.
God, I can imagine. That's horrible.
Yes. So that was one whole side of it, which was that I wanted to eat, but I didn't experience a lot of hunger. I lost my appetite for sure. And I a lot of times had to force myself to eat during pregnancy. And it was sort of like, this is a little bit of a funny, more lighthearted story about it, was I had been sick for a few days, really bad. And then I finally was feeling kind of okay. And I had a good day, right? So occasionally you have a good day in the middle of hyperemesis. And I was having a good day and I felt hungry. And what I wanted was an egg sandwich, like a fried egg sandwich. And I was like, yes, this, I can't wait to do this. So I make myself a perfect fried egg sandwich, just like everything about it is appetizing. My stepdad, I lived with my parents at the time, and my stepdad was like, can you make me one? So I made him one. I carry it over to him. I sit down, and we had like a recliner chair, and I set it down on the recliner part of it. And then I sat down and it flipped the sandwich.
Oh no.
Up into the air and face down on the floor.
Oh.
And this is like a fried egg sandwich, so there was no saving it.
It's like all runny and just floor everywhere.
There was no 5-second rule happening.
No.
By the time this happened, my stepdad is like halfway into his. Okay.
Oh.
And he looks over at me like mid bite, like his eyes like pop open, like super wide. And I screamed and started just like bawling. Just like wailing, crying. And he kind of sort of gestures to me like, do you want this one that I'm eating? And I was like, no, I don't want anything. I can't. I was so upset. Lost it over the egg sandwich.
Oh, it was so just bad.
It was so devastating.
Especially when it's like you don't want to eat or you're having to force yourself to eat, and then finally you're hungry and you're excited about something.
Yes. Like, yes.
Ugh.
Yeah. So that was my main experience with pregnancy. When I got into my experience breastfeeding, that was a whole new ballgame.
Yeah. What was that like?
I chose to breastfeed because it was free. And I'm still a single mom, but I was a single mom with no income. I had not been working the whole time because of my hyperemesis. And I knew I was going to get child support at some point, but you don't have child support on day one. So I was writing at the time. I was making a little bit of money blogging. And that was it. That was my whole income. I was living with my parents and I just wanted to be able to feed my baby for free. And now I know a lot about the reasons to breastfeed. And this is a really good reason that a lot of people have, which is that you can afford to breastfeed because you don't have to pay for it. And I knew that formula was expensive. So that was my main reason. And I took a breastfeeding class, not really knowing much about breastfeeding at all, by the way. And I took a breastfeeding class and it was very persuasive to breastfeed. And it made me feel like it was really important. So that was like a bonus. like the initial reason was, okay, I'm going to have a free way to feed my daughter. But the second reason was that there were quote unquote health benefits. So I chose to breastfeed and I started doing that. And it was a largely positive experience for me. I had some challenges in the beginning, as most people do, the first few weeks of breastfeeding can be really challenging for most women. Not everybody, you know, I talk to moms all the time in my work who have just, I call and they're like, it's great. Everything's going fine, you know? So I don't want to make it a general blanket statement, but for a lot of women, it's very challenging in the first few weeks. And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's many reasons why breastfeeding might be hard, why it might not go perfectly. For me, my daughter had a lip tie, which is where the upper frenulum of the lip goes very far down to the bottom of the upper gum. And it makes it difficult for the baby's lip to flange out, which makes it difficult for them to get good suction at the breast, which is pretty key to getting good milk transfer. And so we had to work really hard to get through that. Her latch never looked perfect the way that we're sort of taught in lactation training to look for a perfect latch. I sort of have learned now that there's rarely a perfect latch. It rarely looks like it, like the picture of what it's supposed to. The perfect latch is really the latch that feels most comfortable to the mother and that has, you know, good transfer. It's what works for the dyad, right? So with breastfeeding, we're always talking about the mom and the baby at the same time. So in my personal dyad with me and my daughter, she struggled with that. So it was painful. She nursed a lot. She nursed very frequently, maybe a little more frequently than the average newborn, and for long periods of time and with a lot of pain in the beginning. But I was able to kind of adjust the latch. I got help with the latch from a lactation consultant. And then I joined La Leche League, which is a free international breastfeeding support group. There are many chapters all around the world and a lot in North America. And there were three in my little corner of the world. So I went to all three and I got some help. I got some technical help and a lot of emotional support from other moms who were trying to breastfeed their children. But specifically where diet culture entered into it was actually later on. So the breastfeeding world is interesting. And I say that as a loving member of that community. But some people in the breastfeeding world have really, I think, unrealistic purity ideas about food. They sort of see breastfeeding as like this, the most natural, the most pure, the most clean eating, which is a lot of like diet culture words, right? And so what happened was I was buying into that and I didn't realize it. Like I wasn't aware that I was buying into it. Now it's crystal clear that it's like, oh, hey, eating disordered person, right, who's had a lot of food issues, is trying to make her baby eat perfect, pure. I was just projecting it onto my daughter. So what happened was I was breastfeeding her, and two kind of things really got in the way with like diet culture-y stuff. So one thing was at 6 months is when infants start solids, right? And there is sort of a movement of people, and a lot of them are like breastfeeding people, called baby-led weaning, which is where instead of feeding pureed baby food, right, or infant cereal, you just feed babies like whole, soft whole foods that they eat themselves with their own hands.
Like cut into tiny pieces, right?
Or sometimes a big hunk too, that they sort of would gum on. So we're talking like a soft avocado slice or a banana, like a ripe banana, things like that. There's a lot of information out there about it, but I sort of bought into it. I was looking for the most pure, perfect way to feed her, right? And there's so much pressure on you as mom to do everything like perfect with your kid. And so I bought into that and I was doing that. The other thing that was tricky was that I was surrounded by a lot of people who just believed that all a baby needs is breast milk. And so they would constantly say this phrase, which is not true, but I would hear it all the time, which was food before one is just for fun.
Oh, God.
And I really want to shake myself when I think about the fact that I believed that, because I just was hearing it from like hearsay. I didn't have any evidence to back this up. I read a blog and I remember being like, when have I ever in my life just taken everything from like a random mommy blog at face value? But for whatever reason, probably my disordered eating past, I did it with my kid. And so when she was about 9 months old, she had started sleeping through the night. So with breastfeeding, babies nurse throughout the night, right? So when they start sleeping for long periods of time, that's like half their calories gone out of the day. She'd also started crawling. So she's more active now physically. And she was not eating the sort of recommended solid foods that she was supposed to be having, because I was doing baby-led weaning and I thought food before one was just for fun. And so I wasn't feeding her as often as she should have been fed. And when I was feeding her, I was feeding her like organic pumpkin and quinoa, like just super low calorie food. And so she lost and she was labeled failure to thrive. And I am in her pediatrician and her pediatrician is like, what is going on? Because to look at her, you would not think that that's what was going on, because she looked very healthy. She was a chunky baby, you know. She was meeting all her milestones and everything. And then I was like, well, I think, do you think maybe it could have something to do with this baby-led weaning stuff that I'm doing? And my pediatrician was like, what? You know, and I sort of learned this really hard lesson that the only time our culture encourages you to gain weight is when you're an infant.
So true.
And losing weight is bad. And I was so, so heartbroken. And I felt so guilty and so ashamed and felt really like this was my fault. We had to make some changes. We started feeding her period baby food and infant cereal, oatmeal cereal. Surprise, surprise, she loved it. Couldn't get enough of it. Was very happy to eat it, you know, 4 to 5 times a day. She was still breastfeeding. I had to go see a GI specialist, make sure it wasn't something to do with that. I had to go to the lactation consultants to make sure I was still producing milk. Like, it was just, it was, and we had to go to like weekly weight checks to make sure that she was getting back on track. I had to give her a high fat diet. So I had to add like heavy cream and olive oil into her baby purees and stuff to help her put weight back on and go the other direction. And it worked. And luckily she is a bright, healthy, beautiful child today. But that whole sort of crisis that I went through as a mom was so rooted in this idea of like clean eating and purity culture. And that was something I really went through.
Oh my God, I bet. I mean, it sneaks up on you. I think diet culture in this day and age is so sneaky. And I talk a lot here about the wellness diet and this way that diet culture masquerades as wellness and fitness and quote unquote clean eating and purity and health, where it's really from the same belief system that created Jenny Craig and Snackwells and all of that. We're getting now clean eating and like some implementations of baby-led weaning. Because I mean, I know people who've done that from an intuitive eating and anti-diet place, and it hasn't been a problem. But I think there's so much out there that is diet culture version of like, you know, if they're going to eat food, have it only be the most whole, pure, blah, 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 you know?
Yes. Can I just say something about intuitive eating with kids too, by the way?
Yeah, yeah.
I think this is like the hardest thing to navigate as a parent because, okay, so when you're feeding your child before the age of 6 months, it's not as if there's some big, huge, wide variety of foods to feed your kid. It's either breastfeeding or formula. So that becomes very black and white to a lot of people. It's like, which one is better? Because there's only two choices. So even in diet culture, there's a wide variety of thought. You can go the huge spectrum from keto to vegan to whatever, right? With totally different rules to clean eating to the wellness diet. There's a whole wide variety. But when you're just feeding your infant, their only two acceptable choices, right, are formula or breastfeeding. So it starts there. And then you get to feeding your child and you just feel an enormous pressure to feed them the right way. And then as they grow a little bit older, you can introduce a huge variety of food into their lives. But it's so hard to allow your kid to be truly an intuitive eater in the way that an adult would be, because they rely on you for preparing their food from infancy. It's not as if they are making the choices at the grocery store and they're making the choices in the kitchen nightly. The best version I can give of that to my daughter is, here's what we have. Here are the choices that are acceptable for tonight. And I think that that's so hard. And I understand why baby-led weaning would feel like it's intuitive eating, because it seems a little bit more led by a child's hunger. You're still making choices for them. And I'm just doing my best as a mom to give my daughter choices and to respect them without giving her an influence of this is healthy or this is unhealthy or what have you. But it doesn't matter what I do, because the world influences her too. So even though I don't use words like this candy is unhealthy or whatever, other people do. And she picks up on that and she brings that to our dinner table every night. She's five, you know? And I don't make food a moral thing. I don't choose to use that language around it, but she hears other people do it. And she's only five. So this idea that I don't know how you raise a truly intuitive eater child. I don't know how you do it, because they are going to be influenced by diet culture and they don't have the full range of choices that an adult has. They just don't. If anyone knows how you do it,
yeah,
I want good advice on it.
I mean, one thing that I think is interesting as I dig in more to this idea of child feeding is like the overlap and some of the nuances between intuitive eating and then what's known as attuned eating, or the division of responsibility in feeding and eating, which is a concept created by Ellen Satter, who's a dietitian who specializes in like child feeding. And her idea of the division of responsibility is kids can't really be responsible for purchasing food or deciding just on a whim what they want to eat. So basically, the parent is in charge of that stuff, of like what the food is going to be and what gets served and what gets purchased and all that, taking into account the child's desires and the child's, you know, interests and stuff. And then the parent is also responsible for when it's going to happen, because there's just time constraints of like, okay, now is when we have time for dinner, time to cook, time to prepare, et cetera. And so the parent provides meals and snacks at regular intervals so that the kid is never going too long without food, but is given some opportunities to eat throughout the day. And then the kid is responsible for whether they're going to eat at that given opportunity and how much they're going to eat. So, you know, if it's like, oh, it's time for afternoon snack and the kid is just not hungry because they had a big lunch or because whatever, they're just not hungry, then they can opt not to have that snack. But if they want that snack and they want to have all of it and then more, you know, then that's also their prerogative.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that's definitely a much more structured way of doing it than with adults, because adults can choose much more in the moment of what they want or go out to eat or something like that. But I think it's a hopefully a good way of balancing the realities of being a parent with letting the kids' intuitive eating skills come into play, at least in terms of how much they're going to eat, whether they're going to eat, et cetera.
Right. I tend to lean toward that. Yeah, for sure. There's no, you have to finish this. There's nothing like that in our house. Yeah. And in that sense, I think kids are really intuitive eaters. And it's interesting too, because noticing the way my daughter eats, I feel like has taught me a little bit about intuitive eating in general. She's so good at eating when she's hungry and like tapering off when she's satisfied. She's so good at it. It's a trip, but it's also like, man, there's a lot of pressure to do it right.
Oh, yeah, I bet. And I mean, curious to hear like how you fight back against or are navigating some of the messages that she's getting from her peers, from diet culture in general. Like, God knows, even kids' TV shows have diet culture bullshit threaded through them. So
in particular, so it's interesting because I am a public health student at the moment, and I'm studying to get my degree in public health, and I'm taking nutrition right now. It's one of my required courses. So it's interesting because I've been learning a lot about food, but trying also to avoid being triggered. My professor is an old school diet culture nutrition professor, and there's nothing I can do about that. He's the only nutrition professor at our college, and he's been doing it a long time, and I don't think I'm going to make a lot of headway with him. So there's been a couple of assignments that I've had to do that are very diet culture-y to me that I would not normally do. So like I had to keep a food diary.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I was like, how can I approach this with my mindset instead of his mindset and still sort of like meet the assignment requirements? And so I was dead honest. That was part of it, which was, it's funny because it took place over the birthday party. One of the days I had to write my birthday party foods in there. One of the requirements of the assignment was that you had to put calories, K calories stuff. That was tough. But I was just honest about it. And then when the part where I felt that I had control was that we had to write paragraphs about what we thought, this is so diet culture, what was our best day? What was our worst day? And then how we could improve.
It's so interesting too, that language is in there. I mean, I think about when I took the same class, the nutrition class with the food diary, like 10 years ago, it was definitely similar language. Like there's, you know, like recommendations for improvements and
yes,
blah, blah, blah. But it's like, ugh, that shit is still happening. It's so frustrating.
Yeah. So thank God I know better. All these other people in my class may not know better, but I felt I had control over those last paragraphs. And so I basically said, you know, I don't think that I had a best day or a worst day. I think these are the foods that I ate. Here's the breakdown of the macronutrients in them according to the AMDRs or whatever. And I talked about it from a neutral point of view. And so that was it. But what's so interesting is that the way he's designed the class is really diet culture-y, but the actual textbook that I'm reading from isn't really that diet culture. It's like, it's not that bad, really. The actual text gives a lot of good information, a lot of factual information, and largely from a neutral point of view. There are some parts of it that are not, for sure. But when Elsie's my daughter, when she asks me questions lately, I've been like, well, actually, the Snickers bar or whatever that you're eating is not unhealthy. It's full of carbohydrates and protein, and those are macronutrients. And I'm sort of trying to take like a neutral scientific approach, which is explain what the food is, what it does. You know, this is fuel for your brain. Even in a Snickers bar, like we can find good elements to that.
I always say all food has nutritional value. There's nothing that is like empty of nutrients.
Right. And so I just talk about it with her from a neutral, you know, scientific way as much as I possibly can. And I am clear with her. I say this often. I say there is no bad food. There is no unhealthy food. There's just this food is a little different than this food. And this food might make your body feel this way. And this food, if you eat a lot of it, might make your body feel this way. And I said, but it might not. And we don't know. And you have to listen to your body and what your body feels. You know, if you start to feel a tummy ache from a certain food that you're eating a lot of, maybe it's time to drink some water. I try to just come at it from like, how do you feel? And I don't say no, I don't really have food restrictions. I do encourage her. The only kind of like food rule that I really have is I encourage her to try 2 bites of a food that she's unsure of, because I think 2 bites, 1 bite is fine, but 2 bites is a little bit better for really telling your palate if you really like it or not. And if she doesn't like it and they don't have to be big bites or anything, but like after 2 bites, she's really like, no, I'm a no on this, mom. Okay. Then she's a no on it. It's fine. And we're not going to force it. But that's my only like real food rule. And then I have the conversation with her. Luckily, I have a really bright kid who can understand a lot. And I definitely try to make it age appropriate, but that's my perspective on how I deal with it. And I also try to role model just eating in front of her and loving food and stopping when I'm full and eating a wide variety of food. I try to make sure that we have a lot of different options.
Sounds like such a different experience growing up for her than it was for you and the family of dieters.
Yes. And I'm really body positive, right? So like, what's really funny is I grew up, I don't know if I should go here or not, but my mom walked around our house naked all the time, right? Okay. Like if she was getting out of the shower, you know, this was her house. And I have actually taken that on from her. It's not like a purposeful thing, but it's like, I'm getting dressed. It's okay if my daughter sees me. So she's seen a lot of body stuff that I just think is normal. She said things to me before, like, mommy, you have a really big belly. And I would just say to her, yeah, I do have kind of a big belly. What do you think about that? And then, you know, in the typical kid way, she would be like, I love it.
It's so cute.
And she does a lot of comparison, right? And she's pretty interested, as a lot of little girls are, I think. She's really interested in when she's going to get bobas, which is what she calls boobs. And this is really funny. We were just like channel surfing one day and she saw the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders show. They have a show.
Oh my God.
They have like a reality show. Just for anyone who doesn't want to be triggered, don't watch the Dallas Cowboys cheerleader show.
Yeah, it's pretty sounds pretty bad.
There is a lot of actual like weight loss diet culture talk in the show. And I don't mean that in just a general like, oh, look at these cheerleaders. Like, I mean, like they actually talk about it. But she saw it just for a minute, right? And she likes cheerleaders. Like when we go to like the college football games or whatever, she wants to watch them and stuff. Which I remember being like totally fascinated by them too. And she saw them and she went, Mom, all they wear is boba holders. Which is what she calls a bra, right?
Oh, that's so cute.
And I was like, you're right. That's all they wear.
Boba holders. Oh, yeah. My God.
All they wear is boba holders.
She sounds very observant. It's really cute.
I love her made up words. I never correct her, which I don't know if that's the wrong or the right thing to do, but they're so cute that I can't help it.
Oh, it's adorable.
I'm like, don't ever lose your adorable, cute stuff.
And then you also do some work as a lactation consultant, right? So I'm curious to hear quickly a little more about that.
Sure. So I'm actually a certified lactation counselor, not a consultant.
Gotcha.
But it's okay. So how I started is I work for a state agency. I started as like the entry level, just beginner breastfeeding peer counselor, which is just a mom who has breastfed, helping other moms and support them with breastfeeding. And then while I was working for my agency, I got my credential and then got promoted to a level 3. I teach breastfeeding class now. I do one-on-one counseling with moms. And I also, you know, I issue pumps at my agency for moms who need breast pumps who qualify for our program. But it's a lot of phone work. It's a lot of calling moms and supporting them while they're at home, trying to nurse their children. And I do community outreach as well. And I just got into that because I became really passionate about helping people with breastfeeding, because breastfeeding can be really challenging in the beginning. And when I would go to La Leche League, there were so many moms struggling with it that my heart went out to them and I felt so much compassion for them that I really wanted to do everything that I could to help. And so I had a friend who worked for my agency who helped me get that first job. And then, you know, while I was working there, I just became even more dedicated to it. The moms who are in my program, they would qualify through my program for thousands of dollars worth of free formula over the course of their children's lives. But they are choosing to breastfeed and forego that. And they're pretty dedicated to it. And I want to help them in any way that I can.
And that's really awesome that you're doing that too, because I can imagine diet culture is so prevalent in lactation consulting. And so to have someone like you to sort of push back on that is great.
So there's a couple of things that are there. Like one thing is there's judgment from both sides. So a lot of like from the, I guess, sort of formula feeding camp, judge breastfeeding. From a sort of, I find that it comes from like a judgment of public breastfeeding a lot, and a judgment of the way women use their bodies, and this view that women's bodies are purely sexual and that there's something wrong or gross about breastfeeding. I have spoken to a lot of people who kind of want to breastfeed need, but no one in their family is supportive of it for those kinds of reasons. And then from the other side of it, there's sort of a, and I think this is really just sort of like, forgive me, but the wealthy white lady woo-woo section of the breastfeeding world that judges formula feeding moms and judges them for not feeding their kids perfect nutrition in their eyes. And neither side is right. Neither of those extreme points of view are correct. So when it comes to breastfeeding, I think any woman who wants to breastfeed her baby, there are many great reasons. There are many practical reasons, health reasons, personal reasons to breastfeed your child. And anyone who wants to do it should be able to legally do it and be as supported as possible. We should have paid maternity leave in our country. We should have laws that protect moms who are pumping at work. You know, I'm very passionate about that. On the other side of it, I think that from that other angle, right, of this purity notion, diet culture notion of breastfeeding, we need to have a lot more compassion. There's a reason that formula exists. And it's because if you look at the history of breastfeeding, at some point in history, everybody was breastfed. And then if you look at the history of it, around the corner of the Industrial Revolution, women had to start working. And what was happening? Their milk supply was going down and they weren't able to feed their babies breast milk because they were separated from their babies for hours and hours at a time. And this put physicians in our country into a panic. Physicians were actually the first ones to start like developing infant formulas to try to meet the needs of these malnourished and starving babies. And what happened like before that, right? So then the formula industry kind of takes off. It changes over the years. We could get really far into that. Women going to work, feminism in the 70s. The 70s is like the lowest rates of breastfeeding in our country ever. And that's been slowly changing. But why is that? It's because women are working. Women are outside the home. They're separated from their infants a lot. And breastfeeding is made more challenging when you're outside of the home. It just is. It's just a fact of it. Okay. Or extended breastfeeding is long-term breastfeeding. So, before formula was developed, either if you had problems breastfeeding, and breastfeeding's always been complicated, by the way. It's not like it's a new thing that the first few weeks of breastfeeding are tricky for a lot of people. So what would have happened is someone in your community, your sister, a neighbor, someone else would have wet nursed your child for you. They would have breastfed your baby for you. Or if you were wealthy, you might have had a servant breastfeed your child, or a slave. And there's a long history of slaves feeding their wealthy white slave owners' children while those women went off and did whatever they were doing that wasn't being a slave. And if there was no wet nurse available, no servant, no slave, babies were either fed a poor substitute like cow's milk or goat's milk or something like that, or like in Russia, there was like a carrot soup concoction. There's a lot of different versions, but those babies often died or starved or were just malnourished and had sometimes brain damage, were underdeveloped, things like that, didn't meet milestones, things like that. So formula was developed as a substitute for breast milk. And I'm so grateful that we have it. I'm so grateful that we're not asking people to live in slavery to feed our babies for us. I'm so grateful that we, if we want to work and we need formula to help us do that, that we can. I'm so grateful that we have an acceptable substitute that can sustain life, that can help babies meet their milestones, you know, and grow. And I think that people who are really in this kind of diet culture brain about breastfeeding, listen, I'm the most pro-breastfeeding person there is, you know, I'm very supportive of it. But you have to also recognize that there is a place for formula and there is a place for you don't know what people's circumstances are. You don't know why they're making the choices that they are. You don't know what pressures or barriers they're facing to breastfeeding. And there are a lot of barriers to breastfeeding. And disproportionately in this country, women of color, especially African American women, face far more barriers than white women do. Okay? They face economic barriers, housing barriers, transportation barriers. There are many reasons why, as well as cultural barriers, that they face that a lot of women just have a greater degree of privilege on. And it's a very privilege to judge a mom who has to formula feed. So either one of those extremes isn't great. A breastfeeding mom shouldn't be judged for wanting to feed her child the way that she wants to feed her child. And the same with a formula feeding mom. You can't judge someone for formula feeding if you have any concept of how many barriers there are to breastfeeding, especially in America.
Oh, so well said. Thank you for that. That's a really interesting history. And I feel like will be useful to a lot of people who are struggling with the pressures, either, you know, to breastfeed or the pressures and societal barriers against breastfeeding, all of that.
But all that to say, as wonderful as it is, and as interesting as the experience of breastfeeding is physically, there's also just a lot of barriers to it that make it very unfair and very challenging. And so my sort of perspective on it is anybody who's breastfeeding should be applauded because they're probably trying really hard and they're pretty dedicated. And anybody who chooses not to or can't breastfeed for any reason, that there should be understanding and compassion towards that person. And it's the same with food. We don't know what's going on with people with their food choices. You know what I mean? There can be so many reasons why someone eats or doesn't eat a certain food, you know, or participates in diet culture or doesn't participate in diet culture. I'm always hearing anti-diet people, like you say, you know, we're not judging the dieter. And yeah, that's my perspective on breastfeeding and in the whole diet culture thing.
Oh, it's so fascinating. Leslie, this has been such a great conversation. I'm so glad we got to connect and talk about all of this stuff. Can you tell people where they can find you and learn more about your work?
Sure. So online, I am The Way at Home Mom. So it's at Way at Home Mom, like stay at home mom, but Way, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And I have a blog also, a WordPress blog called Way at Home Mom. So that's where most of my stuff is. And I talk a lot about mothering, parenting, breastfeeding, body stuff, for sure.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. And again, people can find you at The Way at Home Mom on all the social media. We'll put links to that in the show notes as well, so it's easy to click on through. And thank you again so much for being here. It's really wonderful to talk with you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. I am such a fan, so it's an honor.
Thank you. So that's our show. Thanks again so much to Leslie Monio for joining us on this episode, and thanks to you for listening. If you're looking for some practical tips to help you get started on the anti-diet path for yourself, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to ChristyHarrison.com/strategies to get it. That's ChristyHarrison.com/strategies. If you've gotten something out of this podcast, please help us reach more people who need to hear the anti-diet message by sharing this episode and subscribing to the pod on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. You can see all the places to subscribe at ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. That's ChristyHarrison.com/subscribe. You can also leave us a nice rating and review in your podcast provider of choice, which is another way to help new listeners discover us and which I always so appreciate. To get full show notes from this episode, including all the resources we discussed, plus a full transcript, just go to ChristyHarrison.com/252. That's ChristyHarrison.com/252. And to get the transcript, just scroll down to the bottom of the page and enter your email address. This episode was brought to you by my online course, Intuitive Eating Fundamentals. If you're ready to make peace with food, break free from diet culture, and reclaim the life it stole from you, learn more and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course. That's ChristyHarrison.com/course. A big thanks, as always, to our editor and sound engineer, Mike Lalonde, our community and content associate, Vinci Chui, our administrative assistant, Julianne Watasek, and our transcriptionist, Mycroft Holmes, for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show every week. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography and designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.